Welcome to this week's episode of Active Healthy Aging. I'm your host, Coach Ken. Each week, we will be discussing practical health and fitness strategies and topics to help you regain, maintain, or improve your health and movement practice. Ultimately, our goal is to empower you to create a personal movement practice that will support your activities of daily living, make you fall resistant, and living independently for as long as possible. Okay, we're going to jump right into our first movement concept for this episode. And this one's entitled The SED Principle as it applies to weight loss. So exercise physiologists use this acronym SED, S-A-I-D, to express what should be a fairly intuitive idea. Specifically, it means specific adaptation to impose demands. This simply means that you develop a physiological response to whatever movement practice you do consistently. If you consistently lift heavier and heavier weights in any form of exercise, you'll get stronger in that movement. For example, a squat, a bench press, or a deadlift. Athletes and coaches certainly use this principle to focus their training so they develop desirable qualities like speed, strength, and power. This illustrates the SED principle. Unfortunately, many folks in the general population seem to suffer from a bit of cognitive dissonance, shall we say, when it comes to matching their goals with the movements they are doing at the gym. Let's look at a few examples. Arguably, the primary motivation for the majority of folks going to the gym these days is to lose weight. Let's look at weight loss, for example. As I mentioned in a previous episode, exercise is probably the least effective way to lose weight. You will be way ahead of the curve if you focus more of your attention on your nutrition and certainly reducing your stress levels, because both of these definitely affect weight loss or the inability to lose weight. While it is true that if you're exercising at an intensity above being able to easily carry on a conversation, you're likely creating a caloric deficit. However, most folks aren't willing or able to train at this level of intensity consistently over time. There is a bit of a Puritan work ethic in our DNA that seems to tell us that we need to do a certain amount of time or distance to achieve our ideal weight and then maintain it. Probably one of the biggest myths about weight loss revolves around the notion of doing lots of cardio. Many of the cardio machines these days offer the option for you to put in your age and weight so that it can theoretically tell you how many calories you expended. This is sort of a slippery slope, in my opinion. I would take those calorie numbers with a huge grain of skepticism. Let's look at this, for example. A Snickers bar has about 215 calories. Not sure why I chose a candy bar, but here we are. Maybe it's the way some folks reward themselves after a workout. Let's look at some caloric expenditure examples. If you look at, say, an example of a man, a 160-pound man working at a moderate intensity for 30 minutes on an elliptical machine, and it'll say that he burned 345 calories, or running 3 miles at 10-minute pace for 30 minutes burns 300 calories, so fairly close. I don't know about you, but in my experience, actually running is expending a lot more calories per those 30 minutes than gliding along on most elliptical machines. If you change your intensity by doing interval training, higher intensity for short bursts, you'll burn far more calories per unit of time. So the takeaway is this: try not to use so-called cardio sessions as a primary weight loss tool. The number of actual calories you're burning are probably well below what the machine is calculating. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news on that. Performing short, higher intensity intervals followed by an equal or less amount of time for recovery will burn more calories again per unit time. So try to avoid falling into what I call a transactional mindset, where you're making a deal with yourself and earning or using your exercise to earn food based on calories burned. This is a pretty common practice, I think, and usually it's a recipe for weight loss failure. So in the case of weight loss, the SED principle, specific adaptation to impose demands, we want to elevate our metabolism by choosing an interval style of training described above, where you're doing a unit of work or a amount of time for work and an amount of set time for recovery. Obviously, making an honest assessment of your current nutritional approach is going to be fundamental. Reducing stress is huge, and a lot of people don't realize the undercurrent of hormones like cortisol that, when the levels are elevated chronically, are going to raise your blood sugar levels, and eventually your pancreas can't keep up. And in some cases, folks will become what we call insulin resistant. You've probably heard of this. And this is certainly going to inhibit your ability to lose weight. Probably most importantly, be consistent with whatever regimen you create. Your body's more willing to adapt or change when there are consistent demands placed upon it. One of my mentors said this: a mediocre diet and exercise plan done consistently is far better than some whiz-bang diet or exercise plan that you only follow occasionally. So that's our spiel on the SED principle. So let's move to our movement practice concept for this episode. And we're going to continue the discussion of interval training, kind of the what, how, and why of intervals. So in the previous segment, I did mention interval training. I imagine most of you have some concept of what this is, but I want to offer you a brief explanation of what intervals are in case you're not sure, how to integrate them into your training, and why you should consider incorporating them into your movement practice. So what are intervals? Quite simply, it's just a period of work at a higher intensity than you could sustain for, say, hours, followed by a recovery period before repeating that work interval again. So, how to integrate intervals into your training? As an example, a beginning interval session might consist of 1 minute of work or exercise at an intensity that just allows you to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. This is used by a company called Heart Zones as sort of an indicator. I'm not sure exactly why they chose the Pledge of Allegiance, but I think it's the cadence of the way we say that pledge that allows for a few brief breaths here and there. And so if you can actually say the Pledge of Allegiance while you're doing exercise, you're probably in this range where you're just working hard enough to get an effect. And then if you are on for a minute of exercise and then followed by 2 minutes of easy walking or cycling or whatever mode you're doing, that would be an example of one set. For most active aging adults, a 15 to 20 minute interval session 3 times a week could be very beneficial. As your fitness improves, you can play with the work to rest ratio. Usually, at first, we would start to expand the work period a little bit, maybe at 15-second intervals, 30 seconds, to where you're up to doing a couple of minutes or 3 minutes of work, and then starting to take the least amount of rest you need to recover. And this is where, if you have a heart rate monitor or a Fitbit or one of these other pieces of technology, you can kind of monitor what your heart rate's doing. And typically, As a ballpark figure, everybody's heart rate is a little different or responds differently, but most folks, by the time you get down to 110 or 100 beats per minute, you should be pretty well recovered. So, why you might consider this type of training? It will develop a heart-healthy response to brief bursts of intensity. This is especially relevant if you want your heart to be able to safely withstand an unexpected brief exertion and not damaging your heart. Let's use an example. Say you're watching your grandkids and one of them starts heading out into the street. It would be good to have both the ability to move quickly to recover the child and also not have the exertion cause damage to your heart. Most folks can manage to commit and focus to 15 to 20 minutes of alternating periods of work to rest. To me, the time goes by a lot faster than just grinding away for 30 minutes at the same pace. But again, everybody's different. Intervals can be embedded into your training between strength movements, for example. You might perform a set of body weight squats for 30 seconds, rest 30 seconds to a minute, and then do a set of push-ups for 30 seconds, rest for 30 seconds or a minute, and do a set of body rows for 30 seconds, and then rest for another 30 seconds to a minute. And then finally adding, say, a jump rope or jumping on a rebounder for an additional 30 seconds. So we have all these 30-second work intervals followed by a 30-second to a minute rest in between. But it keeps you focused mentally, and it will help keep your heart rate up in a range that will make you heart healthy. Remember, your heart doesn't know what specific movement you're doing. It only knows there's a demand for oxygen, and that's what causes your heart and lungs to work harder. So it doesn't matter if you're walking, running, cycling, whatever activity you're doing, your heart will respond. Obviously, these recommendations are for those of you that don't have cardiovascular disease or taking medication that affect your heart rate or orthopedic conditions that can cause joint pain. Always check with your healthcare provider before starting any kind of exercise program, or in this case, changing your program dramatically where you start in introducing intervals. These same principles can be applied to water exercise movements as well. So if weight bearing is not an option for you, you can still get your heart rate up safely and not beat on those joints. All right, so now we're gonna get into our wellness thought of the week. And this is one of my all-time favorite quotes by the famous baseball player, Satchel Paige. And his quote was, "How old would you be if you didn't know how old you were?" I just love that quote. Anyway, this famous quote also dovetails nicely with Clint Eastwood's latest film, The Mule. I don't know if you've all seen it, but I recommend it if you haven't. Great movie. You're probably scratching your head, what does this have to do with exercise and healthy aging and all? But I'll fill you in on this very shortly here. So follow me. First, great movie. Clint Eastwood gets better with age, I think. But I want to share a relevant backstory to this movie. We've all heard many cliches about aging, and most of them are pretty sobering or harsh, like life is harsh and then you die. Well, I would like to share the backstory behind a country song by singer Toby Keith that he wrote for Clint Eastwood's movie, The Mule, and how it relates to that Satchel Paige quote I mentioned earlier. It seems that Toby Keith is an avid golfer, and he was partnered with Clint Eastwood at one of Clint's sponsored golf tournaments. They got talking, and Toby Keith asked Clint how he was able to keep up with his work schedule making movies at the age of 88. Clint apparently told him, "I don't let the old man in." Well, that was all Toby Keith needed to write an outstanding soundtrack song for this movie called "Don't Let the Old Man In." There are certainly many challenges that we have or will confront us as we move along life's highway. But having the perspective of not letting our chronological age define us is a worthy goal in my mind. Not letting the old man or old woman in is a strategy worth exploring. None of us can avoid becoming old chronologically, but we do have some control over how we express our age. Like most things in life, it's a choice. So I'll ask you again, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you were? Thank you, Mr. Paige. All right, moving on to our regeneration strategy, I want to encourage you, or the title of this is to make mobility a priority. Most folks that commit to some type of movement practice tend to focus on strength exercise and cardio. Nothing wrong with these. These are certainly valid areas to include, but I would suggest that without maintaining mobility in the right joints, the strength wouldn't be fully expressed, and the ability to move freely during cardio will likely be reduced as well. You see this in the gait of a lot of elderly people, where their steps become shorter and slower and shuffly. As I mentioned in the previous episode, that the body's prime moving joints are arranged in an alternating pattern as either stability joints or mobility joints. As a quick review from that episode, I'll just run through these real quick from head to toe. So the neck is a mobility joint or set of joints. The shoulder blade, the scapula, is a stability joint. The upper back, your thoracic spine, is a mobility joint. The lower back, your lumbar, is a stability joint. Your hips, of course, are mobility joints. Knees are stability joints. And finally, down at the ankles, those are obviously mobility joints. But why do I think this is critical to active, healthy aging? Well, as I always, I'm delighted you asked. When you close your eyes and visualize how an older person moves, what does that look like? I'm guessing that most of you have been programmed to believe that old age equals bent over and shuffling along. While this picture is one that many of us may eventually resemble, it doesn't need to come any sooner than it naturally might. What if we made a sincere commitment to maintaining a functional level of mobility? Like balance, challenges, loss of mobility sort of creeps up on us. One day you realize that, for example, your balance isn't as good as it used to be, or that you're having trouble reaching overhead to put something up on a shelf. Sometimes this restricted mobility is hastened along by a joint surgery or some other type of injury. We get the joint repaired or replaced, but we don't always follow the post-op rehab protocols to restore our full range of motion, if possible. This can result in an almost irreversible loss of mobility. When you observe older adults walking with a shortened, shuffling gait, do you ever think, how did that happen? They used to be so vibrant and active. Certainly, there are lots of unavoidable reasons for the decline of physical function, and there's no guarantee. But I believe that many people could extend their functional capacity far longer than might be generally accepted. This could be considered a negative example of the said principle, where not doing anything really does cause a detriment to our overall health. For example, if there are few or no demands placed on the structures used during gait, the soft tissues will tend to become stiff and the joints may even degenerate. One of my favorite movement expressions is that motion is lotion. And even arthritic joints tend to be happier when they're moved, even if only passively. For some, working in a water environment would be ideal. Others may be able to do more traditional mobility work. Others might benefit from some sort of focused soft tissue work to release trigger points or tissue densities that are causing them pain. The point is, there is an entry point for most folks. You just need to open up to the possibilities and then, more importantly, act on that information. My aim in this is to encourage you to do a little inventory of your own mobility in your joints. That short list again is neck, upper back, hips, shoulders, and ankles. Those joints need to be mobile. If you feel that you might be losing mobility, get with a physical therapist or a fitness professional who's qualified for some guidance on how you might regain or maintain the mobility you have. And that's really the key, to either regain or maintain what you've got. We certainly don't want to lose any more than we have to. A few minutes of consistent and focused mobility work could really extend the quality of your movement and perhaps extend the longevity of your active, healthy aging lifestyle. Isn't that something to aspire to? All right, we're going to shift gears a little bit here and look at what we're going to call a fitness half-truth. I had a list a long time ago of truths, half-truths, and lies. Lies is a little strong, so I'm going to tone that down a little bit. But I think that there are a lot of half-truths out there that are somewhat dangerous in that there are elements of truth in them, but yet people take them as the final word on a subject. So the half-truth I want to discuss today is determining your maximum heart rate by taking the number 220 and subtracting your age. Most of you have probably heard this, or you've seen the little charts on the exercise machines you've been using. This is one of those half-truths that's been elevated to the status of an accepted fact. Unfortunately, it's not accurate. Remarkably, even though cardiologists, exercise physiologists, and fitness professionals have known for years that this formula is not accurate for a great number of people, it persists. If you think of a bell curve, the number of people that formula probably fits is in the upper part of that bell curve, and both the left and the right side of that curve can vary widely. The Reader's Digest version of this widely believed but inaccurate notion dates back to 1970, where a researcher by the name of William Haskell, PhD, was working on guidelines for exercise in patients with heart disease. He had collected a lot of data from 10 published studies on maximum heart rate. When he graphed the data, it seemed to correlate to this 220 minus your age as a quick reference for doctors to give their patients. If you fast forward then a few years, and with the increased interest in safely guiding cardiac patients and athletes to reach appropriate heart rate levels, they started to realize that there was wide variance. Most dramatically were anomalies with young competitive athletes. They saw athletes in their 20s with max heart rates over 200. Well, if you're subtracting your age from 220, that's pretty astounding. So, to make matters more confusing, the major manufacturers of heart rate monitors and cardio equipment started programming their devices using this same formula, 220 minus the age, thus further perpetuating this inaccuracy. Most of you have no doubt seen heart rate charts on the equipment or wall posters at your gym. It has been estimated that the standard deviation can be as much as 10 to 20 beats off. This means that if you're attempting to train at a particular percentage of your heart rate and thinking you're in your so-called fat-burning zone or whatever zone you're trying to go for, you could really be a whole level off in terms of whether you're working way too hard or maybe you're working nearly hard enough. Here's the takeaway from this. For the majority of this audience, the active, healthy agers, I would recommend that you just learn to use your own perceived levels of exertion as a guide for how hard to work. This means that if you were to rate how hard you are working on a scale from 1 to 10, your benchmarks might look something like this. If you're walking at a moderate pace, probably a 5 or 6 out of 10, doing intervals that we mentioned earlier might get you up to a 7 or an 8 out of 10 level of exertion. Another easy upper heart rate limit can be whether you can say the Pledge of Allegiance, as I mentioned earlier, while doing whatever it is you're doing. If you're gasping, for example, you're at a 9, you're probably working too hard. Most folks in this demographic do not need to push themselves to that degree. Unless you're a competitive athlete, you really have no reason to get your heart rate over 90% at this point. One final tidbit on this, there is no correlation between your max heart rate and your fitness level. For a long time, people were walking around like a badge of honor talking about their max heart rate, like if you have a super high heart rate or a super low heart rate, you're somehow different or special. It just happens to be the way you're put together and the way your body functions. Two people of the same age, same relative fitness levels, can have dramatically different heart rates. The most important aspect to monitor in your training is how quickly your heart rate drops. I'll say that again. The most important aspect to monitor in your training is how quickly your heart rate drops. An average person's heart rate should drop about 20 beats in 1 minute after exertion. So if you're working fairly hard, say at a 7 or an 8, and you stop whatever it is you're doing, within 1 minute, you should drop around 20 beats if you're in fairly good shape. A trained athlete might drop as much as 50 beats in a minute. So that is really the definitive difference between a trained or an untrained person versus a highly trained athlete is how quickly their heart rate drops. So if you've completed a challenging interval and your heart rate only dropped 10 beats in the first minute, this could be an indication that you're both not in great shape, but you could even be dealing with some sort of heart disease. So you might want to get that checked out. Again, for most of this audience, just use the talk test above as your ceiling, upper limit. You'll probably be fine. If you have a history of cardiac disease, best get some guidelines from your cardiologist. Otherwise, just as with the calories burned estimates on machines, heart rate zones are vary tremendously between individuals. So now you know. And we're going to finish up today with our fitness fun fact, Indian clubs. Some of you may have seen these in old pictures of gyms in the United States, or, well, all over the world, actually. They got their name from India when British soldiers being stationed there started picking them up and using them for mobility. From the mid-1880s to the 1920s, Indian clubs were as common as dumbbells are in most gymnasiums. Club swinging became popular with both men and women because they only weigh 1 to 2 pounds. It was actually part of military fitness, like at West Point and Annapolis, for many years. They have found a bit of a resurgence today in the United States, thanks to Dr. Ed Thomas. And these clubs originally came out of the Middle East and so forth. So besides being a fairly old form of strength training, they can be an outstanding tool for regaining and maintaining excellent shoulder mobility. So I would encourage you to check out a light set of Indian clubs, check out a video or two to see how to do it properly, and start swinging. So as we finish up the show today, I want to remind you that you're listening to Active Healthy Aging on KCIW 100.7 on the FM dial. I'm Coach Ken, and I want to pass along our standard disclaimer at this point that the information and opinions expressed on this show are for informational and entertainment purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, and or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or healthcare provider regarding any medical issue you may be experiencing. Until next time, be well, be fit.